You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We're going to have a very good discussion on title, Opportunities and Challenges in Cross-Strait Relations. And we have four excellent panelists who I will introduce in turn. The first is our old friend Alexander Wong, who was a visiting fellow here in the early days in my center. It's always great to invite him back. And do you want to speak from there or from the podium? It's up to you. Okay. Welcome.
Yes, we have 12 minutes. It's really hard for a professor to speak for only 12 minutes, because we won't get paid if we don't do 3 hours. In this month, exactly 20 years ago, Beijing cut off the institutional dialogue with Taiwan between Straits Exchange Foundation and the ARATS. And also exactly this month, 20 years ago, that Beijing lobbed missiles to the waters in the Taiwan Strait. So 20 years has passed. The experience of many in this room will not be repeated again because the 20 years of difference. China has become the second largest economy in the world, the largest trading nation in the world. China has a military capability to project power way beyond the first island chain. And China has had an anti-secession law that they did not have 20 years ago. Taiwan has changed as well. Taiwan experienced the two times of change of governments. And Taiwan also has a new referendum law that we did not have 20 years ago. So judging from the fact 20 years later that now we have 890 flights across the Taiwan Strait, direct flights, every week, and 64 destinations, airports, that the cross-strait flights goes to on the mainland. It is very hard to recall what we have been through 20 years ago. And today, if anything happened across the Taiwan Strait, that how the play will be presented again. In January 2009, about 1 month after the full implementation of the big three links or direct air link across the Taiwan Strait, I was invited by Alan Romberg to give a talk at the Stimson Center. And he asked me to talk about the future cross-strait relationship. And that was the beginning of the Ma Ying-jeou administration. I gave five trends that I envisioned then. I said the cross-strait dialogue will turn from fast to slow, from easy to complicated issues, from economic-centered issue to more political-sensitive issue, and fourthly, from bilateral issues to the issues that may involve third parties. And number five, moving from the well-discussed issue to those issues that not studied yet. And 6 years later, when I review what I said about the 5 points, it is so true that we are getting into the deep water. And it's very hard to manage the cross-strait relations, no matter which party is in power. In the past 7 years, we have signed 22 agreements under the Ma Ying-jeou administration across the Taiwan Strait. But in recent months, we see a slowdown of the cross-strait dialogue. It was because of several obvious reasons. One is that protracted political process in Taiwan under a kind of partisan struggle. And also there has been a growing anxiety among the people, especially the younger generation, worrying about the growing Chinese dominance and Taiwan's ability to make a choice for their own future. Also, it was caused by China. I think Minister Xia just gave us some very good examples from the pronouncement of ADIZ in November 2013, to the announcement of the flight route M503, and to the unilateral decision on the part of China to change the passport-like travel documents to travel cards. Most recently, only last week, that the Chinese National, the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress passed a new revised national security law and imposing so-called obligation for the Taiwanese compatriot to support the Chinese sovereignty. So all these, I try to think about a term. 20 years ago, I was in foreign service together working for Andrew Shaw at TECRO. By then, we talk about one kind of term called verbal annexation through international media, through propaganda. But observing what had happened in the past 2 years under the leadership of Xi Jinping, I think China is now adapting a strategy, I call that a legal annexation, through China's making of its domestic law and try to gradually, incrementally encroach Taiwan's sovereignty and poison the future cross-strait relationship. In the next several months, we will experience another democratic process in the Taiwan's presidential election. From the registration of candidate to the ballot to the election day will be 55 days. And from the election day to the inaugural is 126 days. And that's a long period of uncertainty. And for the past several years, I did not agree any of my students to write a paper or do a degree dissertation under the name, under the title of trilateral, U.S.-China-Taiwan trilateral relationship, if they are trying to talk about the period between 1998 and 2008, because I did not consider that a trilateral relations. Trilateral relationship, for me, means three sets of bilateral relationship. I sincerely hope that we can work together and pray for the best and see the three sets of bilateral relationship continues to work in the future. It may be another 34 years before Xi Jinping's China dream can be fulfilled. To the year 2049. And for me, it means that China needs to maintain another 34 years of one-party rule, another 34 years of party controls the gun, another 34 years of reasonable economic growth, and another 34 years of cyber cops. And that's not easy for Xi Jinping either. So with all that, I think I will conclude right here and wait for the Q&A session. If I have any remaining minutes, I will yield that to Alan Romberg. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alexander. Our next speaker is Samuel Wu Xiaoguang. He's an adjunct professor at the Department of Public Administration and Policy at National Taiwan University. Professor Wu?
Richard, ladies and gentlemen, I think I just sit here and talk. My name is Samuel Xiaoguang Wu, and I'm currently an adjunct professor at the Department of Public Administration and Policy at the National Taipei University. And actually, I'm also the chairman of the CDIB and Partner, which is an international private equity fund stationed in Taipei. And it is my pleasure and my distinct honor to be invited here to attend this discussion on the opportunity and challenges in cross-strait relations. And my assignment, as I understand, is to talk about the linkage between Taiwanese domestic politics and cross-strait relations. I think I got this assignment partially because I was once a participant of the Taiwanese domestic politics. I serve in several different capacities in the Taipei City government when President Ma was the mayor of Taipei, and also when the previous Mayor Hao was the mayor during his first term. And I left the government job about 6 years ago and went back to the academic job. And then I took this chairman job about 5 years ago. And my investment team actually invested heavily in the United States, Japan, Southeast Asia, and mainland China. And therefore, my main job in that capacity is to research paper on the investment environment on those areas. And therefore, it is not that different, actually, from my academic job. The only difference is that when I make bad judgment or read wrong interpretation on those research results and information, I end up lose real money. So I have to be very careful. And I have to put whatever information that I got into a balanced and appropriate context so that I don't get carried too far away from any one piece of interesting information. And at the same time, if there is a trickling factors of a possible chain reaction, it is not ignored simply because it is a small thing. So I don't pretend that I have any insider's information about Taiwanese domestic politics. Instead, what I try to do here is to provide an analytical framework that I use and put whatever information about Taiwanese domestic politics that I got into this context, and then think about the possible scenario development and their implications. And I hope that my imagination may somehow contribute just even just a little bit toward today's discussion among such a distinguished group of real experts and informed audience on this subject. So on linkage politics between domestic factors and interstate relations has always been a category of variables that raise a lot of tension among observers of the cross-strait relations. For example, the possible change of national leadership in Taiwan in 2016, that's next year, may just be a significant factor to the future of the cross-strait relations. If a new KMT leader is elected as the successor to President Ma, then it is likely that President Ma's current rapprochement policy will be continued. However, if a DPP leader is elected as the new president, then it may create great uncertainty to the future of the relations. So, to what extent the cross-strait relations will be influenced by the transition of leadership in Taiwan? Will the leader be constrained by the already existed structural factors, or he or she? I think this time it's more than likely it's going to be a she. Is more of a determined factors to the future of the cross-strait relations. What are those structural factors? are, and in what way those factors will shape the future of the cross-strait relations. So I will try to answer these questions by focusing on mainland Chinese leaders' possible decision against Taiwan in this specific strategic environment, and then think about the possible response from Taiwan and from the United States. So let's take a look at the analytical framework itself. If we take a look at the literatures that discuss about the change in cross-strait relations as the dependent variables, most of them will discuss about this from the following three categories of factors. The first one is the international factor, and the second is the interactive factors between the two sides. What I mean by interactive factors implies the memories of the past and the mode of the most recent interactions and the expectation about the future interactions. And the third one is the linkage factors of domestic politics to the cross-strait relations. And I think the most direct factors is the interactive factors. For example, the recent rapprochement between the two sides has been the direct result of the change of national leadership in Taiwan in 2008. And the expectation that things may get better by the mainland Chinese leadership is apparently a significant factor that convinced them to make economic concessions to Taiwan on the negotiation table for the last 7 years. However, the political leader on both sides are constrained by the international system factor and their domestic politics. For example, mainland Chinese leader may want to take assertive action against a pro-independent Taiwanese leader. But if the United States is in support of Taiwan strongly, and the China's move is constrained. And so I'm strongly suggest not to use a PowerPoint. So I cannot show the figure to all of you. But actually, I got several figures to structure those factors together. But anyway, what I'll try to do here is to just take a look of these three categories of factors separately. So let's take a look at the first one, the international factor. I think the most important international factor will influence Chinese leaders' decision on the level of assertiveness against Taiwan. That's the way I operationalize it, is the level of the U.S. support to Taiwan. And however, the U.S. support to Taiwan is also mostly influenced by two other factors, the power balance between the U.S. and China and the strategic interdependence between U.S. and China. So because of the constraint of the time, I think I'm not going to go through all those variables very carefully. Maybe what I should do is just to go directly to my conclusions. After I examine all these three categories of variables, and then also to put them into a three sides, what I call the two-level games, and then it is quite possible for us to think about the possible loop of influence among the three leaders, the leader of the United States, the leader of China, and the leader of Taiwan. And I think what I'm trying to do is to put all those possible events along these three categories of variables on a time stream. And I first put all those events that scheduled to happen along the timeline from 2013 to the end of 2017. And I put together this, I call it a future events chart. And so through all those future events chart and also categorize them into all those three different categories, and then you start to think, you start to see the possible action and interactions among all those events and the possible loop of influence that implemented by the three possible players, which are the three political leaders. And then you can start to have some scenario development out of what might happen, because one or another particular event trigger the whole chain reactions. So I was simply jump to the what I got out of that piece of the analysis. I think looking to the future, there's no guarantee that cross-strait relations will surely turn into the better. And in a previous study, actually, I argued that mainland China's expectation that a much hostile leader may be selected by the Taiwanese voter in the future may actually force Chinese leader to compromise more with the current Taiwanese leader. And that's what happened in the last 7 years. But the second thing is that when a much hostile leader is elected as the Taiwanese president with a much friendly opposition party to a mainland China, that's what might happen next year, may actually make the much hostile new leader have less room for negotiation against mainland China. And the political language between the cross-strait relations and the respective domestic politics, especially Taiwan's presidential election, can be a very powerful triggering effect that will influence the future of the relations. Actually, I have a chance to interview some of the mainland Chinese observers of Taiwanese politics and ask them how they think about the future of cross-strait relations if the DPP candidate Tsai Ing-wen is elected as the president of Taiwan. And they actually express three deep concerns. First, they believe that once Tsai is elected, the separatist education of Taiwanese younger generation that started by the previous DPP president Chen Shui-bian will certainly be continued and even be strengthened. And second, they believe that the unfriendly events initiated either by the Taiwanese local governments or by private sector, such as an invitation of Dalai Lama to visit Taiwan, will be much likely to happen and will be much less easy for the Tsai's administration to avoid. And when this happened, it will certainly raise a lot of domestic pressures to President Xi Jinping and to force him to respond assertively. And three, they believe that the Tsai's administration will much likely to choose a closer position with Japan and the United States in international disputes between China and the US-Japan allies. For example, it may be natural for Tsai's administration to support Japan's claim of free navigation right in the South China Sea, but this may be perceived by many Chinese as a betrayal of the motherland in favor of Japan, and to provoke very strong domestic resentment inside of China. And when it happens, the situation may force Xi to take very strong reaction in response. Just as demonstrated in my future events chart, so the recent cross-strait agreement on trade and service is not ratified by the Taiwanese legislative yuan, and then if the KMT split because of its defeat at the 2016 presidential election, then this event will send very important signals to the mainland China, mainland Chinese leader. First, it showed that the President Mao's rapprochement policy does not support it by the majority of the Taiwanese, and the current peace development between the two sides of the strait does not gain political popularities for China's reunification dream from the majority of the Taiwanese. And second, it demonstrated that the new DPP government is less likely to further Taiwanese rapprochement toward mainland China. And as a result, the resume of the ruling position by the TPP in 2016 were likely to be perceived by mainland China as a major setback to its rapprochement policy toward China, and this situation will be a significant pressure on mainland Chinese leader Xi Jinping. And since the setback is likely to be interpreted as the failure of his leadership, and as a result, he may be compelled to react strongly under the domestic pressures. What we can do about it? I think it is quite important for the for us to remember that although for the last 7 years, the relationship seems to be peaceful and in good development, but the situation may turn to the worst very soon. So it is very important for us to pay a lot of attention and think about the possible cost, no matter what particular policy that we choose. And the good news is, I think Tsai Ing-wen understand the possible danger here. He tried hard this time when he was in the CSIS to articulate her idea of preserving the status quo. I think she tried to send out a message that she accepts the current Taiwanese constitutional order and her position on the cross-strait relation is equivalent to that of the 92 consensus. And he tried to send out the message without actually saying it. Therefore, her position seemed to be acceptable to the United States. And the United States is not in the position to tell Tsai what she should do. However, when Tsai's decision is moving away from the core interest of the United States, I believe that the United States will somehow let her know where the red line is. And a stable and peaceful cross-strait relations is one of the core interests of the United States and high in U.S. national security priority list. Although the U.S. is not on the position of abandoning Taiwan at all, Taiwanese leaders should not count on the United States to the rescue when Taiwan intentionally provoked China, such as what previous President Chen Shui-bian did during his administration. Instead, in order to maintain a constructive relationship between the United States and China, I think the U.S. will pressure Tsai's administration back to his track if she really follows Chen's strategy. So therefore, independence is not an option for Taiwan for the next 4 years to come. And if Tsai's administration choose to go that way, I think Taiwan will have to prepare to deal with an assertive China all by itself. So if Tsai wants to enhance the U.S. support to Taiwan, one of the things that she may do is to join the DPP. However, unable to do that, he will have to liberalize Taiwan's domestic market. Otherwise, it's next to impossible for Taiwan to join the regional integration organization. And it is certainly detrimental to Taiwan's strategic position in the region if we don't join that particular organization. But this will be another linkage politics issue that should be analyzed next time. So I'll just stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Wu. Our next speaker is Alan Romberg. He's a distinguished senior fellow at the Stimson Center. Alan?
Okay, there we go. Thank you very much, Richard, and thank you to the sponsors for including me in this. I'm going to speak reasonably fast so I can try and observe the 12 minutes, but since I have Alexander's kind yielding of time, I will take perhaps a minute or so advantage of that. The major factors affecting opportunities and challenges in cross-strait relations are pretty obvious. On the one hand, political developments in Taiwan, and on the other, the PRC reaction. What's less obvious, of course, is what those developments will be and what those responses will be. As to Taiwan politics, according to virtually all public opinion polls, except for a very brief period, when Hung Hsu-chu first emerged as the likely KMT nominee, there's been, and still is, a very broad consensus in Taiwan that Tsai Ing-wen will win the election in January, and current polls show her strongly ahead. That doesn't mean she will win, but that is the current popular consensus and the current state of play. The only real questions that people have puzzled over are what the margin of victory will be and whether the DPP, in fact, will also win control of the legislative yuan. This latter issue emerged, I would say, in particularly stark relief as Ms. Hung has struggled to clarify her position on cross-strait relations, generating concern within the KMT ranks, both among the presumed LY candidates and in the party leadership. In terms of cross-strait policies of the two parties, what we see could be called studied ambiguity on the part of Tsai Ing-wen and, shall we say, less studied ambiguity on the part of Ms. Hong. Both have created a certain level of concern and confusion. As is pretty universally understood, Tsai will not embrace the so-called political foundation identified by the mainland, including by Xi Jinping personally, of endorsing the 1992 consensus or any other form of one China and opposing Taiwan independence. But the question on the Taiwan side is whether either during the election campaign or, more important, afterward, if she wins, she will adopt any of the so-called poison pill positions that she and his colleagues have identified, such as one country on each side, Taiwan independence, denial of the 92 consensus, or some other kind of rejection of one China. As those of you who may have had the misfortune of reading some of my recent writings will know, I see a debate in the mainland about this, and even now some differences in the way the PRC addresses the importance of embracing the political foundation on the one hand, and its position on the espousal of unacceptable policies, what I'm calling poison pills, on the other, and I'll elaborate shortly. But here what I'd observe is that Dr. Tsai seems determinedly avoiding openly provocative positions. She's tried in recent months not to comment on the 92 consensus or on one China. And while she has referred to autonomy, zizhu, she's even foregone opportunities to refer to Taiwan's sovereignty, zhuquan, all previously staples of her comments. So what do you end up when you put this together with her remarks on June 3rd at CSIS? Recall that in her remarks, she spoke of conducting, quote, the peaceful and stable development of cross-strait relations in accordance with the will of the Taiwanese people and the existing ROC constitutional order, and how, quote, the accumulated outcomes of more than 20 years of negotiations and exchanges should be treasured and secured and would serve as the firm basis of her efforts to further the peaceful and stable development of cross-strait relations. While intriguing, this has not been totally reassuring to analysts, as various parts of her comments can be interpreted in different ways. But one thing you can see in these remarks, I believe, is a carefully crafted position that, while seeking to be acceptable in Taiwan, also seeks to respond both to the mainland and to American concerns that a Tsai presidency should not upset the current situation in cross-strait relations. While not embracing the specific provisions of the political foundation, Tsai has laid out a position that, if implemented in a straightforward fashion, could be viewed as not inconsistent with the elements of that foundation. Note the phrase, more than 20 years of negotiations and exchanges. This would seem designed to encompass 1992, not openly embracing the 1992 consensus, of course, but not attacking it either, or moving away from the record of achievements under it. And reference to the accumulated outcomes as the, quote, firm basis of her efforts to further peaceful and stable cross-strait relations would seem to be a direct response to Deputy Assistant Secretary Susan Thornton's remarks here just 2 months ago in this building on the importance of just such a basis. With Deputy Speaker Hong, after all the recent Sturm und Drang, what we have come down to is basically a continuity of the Ma administration's policy of one China respective interpretations and adherence to the 1992 consensus. It took a while to get there, and it's clear that some damage has been done to the KMT in the process. I mean, after all, even if she's right that reporters, quote, are never able to correctly understand, close quote, what she says, and I'm not arguing that is necessarily the case, but anyway, that's not an explanation. It's a revelation that she needs to express herself in terms that can be correctly understood. In any event, that's where things are now. And if she's indeed nominated and elected, I expect her to continue most of the Ma administration's basic cross-strait approaches. The final two things I'd say about the Taiwan side of the equation are, A, the impact of the so-called third force in Taiwan politics is not entirely clear at this point, but at a minimum, it's not going to encourage the movement by the DPP toward any more explicit acceptance of PRC positions. And B, James Sung seems much more seriously interested in running than one might have guessed, and he might have more support than one might have guessed. But if he runs alongside a KMT candidate, the outcome seems pretty certain. We saw that movie in 2000. If it ends up that he's the only blue candidate, that could put things in a different light, but I don't see how that's going to happen. So then the questions become, how will the PRC react to the election, and what is the likely course of cross-strait relations in the future? I see something of a debate in the mainland between those who believe there must be serious consequences for any Taiwan administration that does not accept one China and oppose Taiwan independence, on the one hand, and on the other, those who, while agreeing there cannot be progress in such a situation, and inevitably there will be some degree of setback, do not see a need to punish Taiwan as long as Taipei does not engage in provocative actions or adopt provocative positions vis-a-vis sovereignty-related issues. As George W. Bush might have said, whatever anyone else in China thinks, there will, of course, be only one decider. And Xi Jinping has taken some pretty tough positions. Meeting with KMT Chairman Zhu Lilun in May, he said, if one were to deny the 1992 consensus, challenge the legal basis of both sides of the strait belonging to one China, advocate one country on each side, or one China, one Taiwan, there cannot be peace, there cannot be development. But even in what Xi said, one could see a nuanced position. That is, while he insisted on the fundamental importance of the political foundation, he spoke in more dire terms about situations where somebody actually denied or challenged the basic positions or advocated antithetical ones. As to the PRC's approach to Deputy Secretary Hong, even though I think Beijing will certainly not love all of her positions, just as it hasn't loved everything Ma Ying-jeou has said or done, if she were to be elected, we could expect from Beijing a pretty much steady-on-course approach regarding cross-strait ties and further agreements. An interesting question to me, anyway, is even then, whether things remain boxed in by the LY, or if that were the case, whether this would affect Beijing's enthusiasm for signing more agreements, how would Beijing play this? Another consideration is that if the mainland sticks to its current position that Minister Xia mentioned, the ECFA agenda must be completed before other aspects of Taiwan's aspiration for greater international economic participation, Taiwan's ability to diversify its international economic links, even on a bilateral basis, much less a regional one, could face some serious constraints. This obviously would be the case, of course, if the DPP is elected, indeed, probably much more so. The interesting thing to watch here, however, is whether a ruling DPP might not take a more pragmatic approach to cross-strait agreements than we've seen over the past few years. That is, while there might still be some substantive aspects of the agreements that DPP would insist on fixing, once it's no longer confronting a Ma administration, it might become easier for the DPP to see its way clear to coming to terms with Beijing. In any case, even if Beijing is not in a punishing mode, one point on which most observers seem to agree is that if there is a DPP administration with its present positions, official, that is MAC TAO, and quasi-official, that is Sef Arret's ties, would be seriously affected, and no new agreements would be signed. Whether the substance of the pending or planned ECFA implementing agreements would somehow be moved into other channels is unclear. But working through existing mechanisms would certainly be pretty much off the table. My sense is also that though Beijing will in any case remain quite constrained in terms of Taiwan's international space, well, a KMT victory would mean continuity in at least such areas as inviting a Taiwan observer to the World Health Assembly. A DPP victory could well see a change on that score. The survival of the so-called diplomatic truce would also seem probable with the KMT victory, but at least an important measure could quite possibly erode with a DPP win. Sun Yafu, the deputy at Arret's, formerly deputy at the TAO, was in Taiwan a few weeks ago and was pretty explicit about all this. Indeed, he made the most extensive public statement that I've seen about the consequences of the common political foundation being weakened or undermined. Giving more specificity to Xi Jinping's statement that relations would become turbulent, Sun went on to say that consultations would be broken off, conditions for exchanges and cooperation would shrivel up, and management of issues related to foreign affairs would become difficult to handle. That's a quote. He also said that obtaining the benefits of trade and investment with the mainland and of Taiwan's participation in regional economic activities all required that cross-strait relations be what he called compatible with such arrangements. Whether in the meantime Beijing will do anything to try to affect the outcome of next January's elections remains to be seen. The mainland has learned the Zhu Rongji lesson, so it won't be blatant about it. But there are things one could imagine that Beijing could do over the coming months if it wanted to demonstrate the benefits of the current approach and implicitly the costs of a different one. It could do so, for example, with regard to Taiwan's participation in the AIIB, or wrapping up the negotiations of the CEF ARITS offices, or even providing assurances that if a peace accord were to be negotiated, as Hong advocates, the mainland would not use such a negotiation to try to force a formal political agreement on the status of the two negotiating parties. It could, but I doubt it will. Rather, in light of the projected DPP victory, the PRC attitude seems to be that as long as no overtly provocative steps are taken by Taipei, Beijing probably feels no pressure to take such positive steps. Instead, it feels that if necessary, it can afford to see a cooling of cross-strait relations at the government level, even if aspects of people-to-people exchanges continue. That said, to conclude, in light of the very serious challenges the PRC leadership faces on other fronts, there's a question about how far it really would want to go in seeing deterioration of cross-strait relations. Absent a direct challenge to One China, it seems to me a security crisis is highly unlikely. But regarding any other scenario, while I've offered some thoughts, the fact is that none of us knows. And I'm sure this is a subject being given considerable attention in Beijing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Our last speaker is Guo Baogang. He's a professor at Dalton State University College. I confess that I didn't know where Dalton State College was. Dalton is in Georgia. It's in the Smoky Mountains. And so we're very pleased that he came down from the mountains to talk to us today. Professor Guo.
Thanks for having me. The advantage of being the last speaker in this panel is that all my punchlines are taken. I guess I will try to be brief and make several remarks. And first of all, I want to say that the past 7 years, the cross-strait relationship has been at its the best. And what has been achieved in the past 7 years have far exceeded what has been accomplished in the past 60 years. So as some of the number has indicated by previous speakers, we have seen 22 agreements has been worked out, and we have seen something between like 10 million visitors and visiting each other across the Taiwan Strait. And on the mainland side, we see that there are over 90,000 Taiwanese business investment or project has been approved, and the trade volume between the two sides has steadily increased to something close to $200 billion. And that number is twice the amount of the trade volume between China and Russia. And it's about one third of the size of US-China trade volume, which is very significant. And speaking from my personal experiences, I came from Henan province in Zhengzhou, in China. And in my city, we see the Foxconn, the Taiwanese business, came to my city and set up some huge assembly plants. And as a result, now 70% of the iPhone sold in the world are produced in this little city called Zhengzhou, 70%. So you can see an impact of Taiwan investment in China. However, the positive trend that we haven't seen in the past 7 years is not stable. It's very fragile, actually. It can be reversed by political development, such as the upcoming Taiwan presidential elections. If any of the candidates choose to abandon the so-called One China principle, I would imagine there will be some consequences, as some of the speaker has noted. So the second point I will make is that what has developed in the last 7 years has a lot to do with Mr. Ma Ying-jeou's mainland policy. So he is the play a vital role, and plus the Kuomintang, in the warming up of the relationship across the Taiwan Strait. I guess there are a couple of reasons for Ma Ying-jeou's initiative. One is the two decades of turbulent pro-independent administrators under the Li Denghui and Cui Shibian has really stirred up the waters and even causing Taiwan's allies, United States, very upset. We know that under George W. Bush's administration, and he forced to abandon the U.S. long-held policy of strategic ambiguity, and now he made it clear that the U.S. Only recognized the PRC to be the state of the sovereign state, and Taiwan is part of China. So, you know, United States never said that publicly. So now what Chen Shui-bian has done forced the Bush to come forward with more clear statement, which really narrowed the space for Taiwan. I think Ma Ying-jeou has realized that Taiwan need to make a good turn with the United States and not further deteriorate the trust and relationship between the two sides. The second major factors led to the Ma Ying-jeou's decision to warm up relation has a lot to do with the international economic environment. As we know, as the Doha round negotiation has hit the bottom for the World Trade Organizations, and all the regional trade agreement has proliferated, and many countries rushed to sign bilateral or multilateral free trade agreement. And many of them, like one speaker previously has stated, they look for China for approval before they can do anything similar to Taiwan, because for their fear of funding China's one China policy. And Taiwan being a export-oriented economy was really in a serious disadvantaged position if the current regional and bilateral trade blocks being created, and that will threaten the Taiwan's export economy. I think that Ma Ying-jeou quickly accepted Vincent Shaw's idea that to work out something with the mainland, to build something like a common market with the mainland, so that at least they can push forward with the economic liberalization and to further sign more FTP with other countries. So the scorecard here really is the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, the ECFA. And so under the treaty, under this agreement, and Taiwan has again a much wider access to the mainland market, and even mainland willingly to give more concessions than any other its trading partners to almost give a equivalent to like a 60% preferential treatment to the Taiwanese product. But the effort to continue in the same direction to further liberalize the service trade has hit the bottom rock. For some reason, as we saw in the media, when the Kuomintang trying to bring this service trade agreement to the legislative yuan, and some upsetting use took on the sunflower movement, and they occupied the legislative yuan trying to prevent the passage of this trade agreement. So there was really a major setback for Ma Ying-jeou's effort to continue to promote economic exchanges with the mainland. It's a major setback. And now, the third point I want to make is that despite all those positive development, we also noticed that the importance of Taiwan in the Sino-U.S. relationship and also the cross-strait economic relationship have declined due to the marginalization of Taiwan. And so in terms of U.S.-China relationship, we see the two countries now focus more important issues other than the Taiwan issue. They move forward and working on, you know, to keep working on issues like global anti-global terrorism, you know, environmental protection. So in other words, the Taiwan issue is no longer as occupied the central place as what used to be. The rise of China in the last 33 decades, we have seen the you know, the comparison between the economic strengths across the strait has tilted more favorably towards the mainland. Taiwan's economy used to be considered a significant amount of a mainland economy, one third the size of mainland economy, and now it's the mainland economy, I have some numbers, probably many times bigger than Taiwan's. We used to look for Taiwan, you know, consider them to be our rich brothers, and they always come in with a sense of arrogance and look down upon the mainlanders. Okay, and now I feel like, okay, the Chinese tourism suddenly pour into Taiwan, they're buying everything, and there's a sense of imbalance going on. And the trend will continue with the China projected rise to become a number one economically in a matter of the next decades. So Taiwan probably will feel more marginalized down the road. So the consequences of a marginalization is that it will give more power to the mainland when they deal with Taiwan. And maybe the right to speak, we saw the Hua Yuquan, may no longer are in the hands of the Taiwanese. Maybe the Chinese government on the mainland may want to control agenda, may want to set a timetable down the road rather than to postpone the so-called unification indefinitely. So that's a possibility. But domestically, we see the marginalization has also led to, you know, some previous speaker has pointed the frustration among the Taiwanese youth, and rather than facilitate the sense of nationalism or xuanong yishui, the blood thicker than water, where we see this more development of Taiwanese identity among the Taiwanese. So that actually is contrary to what the mainland has hoped for. And so this is something to be watched for, how this is going to eventually work out. And finally, just a few words about the upcoming Taiwan election. As I mentioned, whoever win will be a very significant event. And we have the war of two women. And if Tsai Ing-jeou want to consider herself to be Chinese, then she's making history and be probably the second leader in Chinese history to be the number one leader. The previous one was Wu Zetian. And also, as Time magazine noticed, and she's the first one to lead a real Chinese democracy. That's also significant. But because the Tsai Ing-wen has adopted an ambiguous position on the Taiwan issue, and nobody knows exactly what she wanted, even though she took a moderate position, and really caused a lot of worries among the mainland people. I think even more worrisome is that there's a possibility not only the DPP win the presidential election, occupy the executive leadership, but also there's a possibility that DPP might retake over the majority seats in the legislative yuan. So last time we see what happened, it's during Chen Shui-bian's administration where the DPP controlled both the executive and the legislative, and things really turns very down to the south. So who can guarantee this is not going to happen again? All right, so my time's up. I'll stop my comments right here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Guo. Thanks to all the panelists for their presentations. I think you've probably stimulated a lot of questions. I have a lot, but I'm going to restrain myself in the interest of having a lot of audience participation. So, once I recognize you, please wait for the mic, identify yourself. If you want to direct your question to a particular person, please indicate and keep your question short. So who would like to ask the first question? Mike Fonte.
Thanks to the panelists for fine presentations. I'm Mike Fonte. Excuse me. I'm the DPP's mission director here in Washington. Dr. Wu, you mentioned several times, I'm not a linguist like our friend up there, but hostile Tsai Ing-wen, hostile to China. I don't believe that's her position, and I think that's a false designation for her. And Dr. Gao, you talked, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard you say that George Bush agreed that Taiwan was part of China. There had been a shift in U.S. policy. I've been working for the DPP for 14 years now. I lived through the Chen Shui-bian years. Never has the United States agreed that Taiwan is part of China. The position is clear that the status of Taiwan has to be agreed to mutually and peacefully by both sides because the U.S. never accepted Taiwan as part of China. I'd like you to clarify where, if anywhere, you got that statement. Thank you.
Professor, do you want to respond?
Yeah. Well, I have to admit that I have to use the language carefully. I actually, on paper, I use it as quote unquote. Okay. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to say is that compared to President Ma, it seems to me that Tsai Ing-wen is perceived by Chinese leader a little bit, you know, hostile than Ma when it comes to her position against China. That's the only thing that I would try to say.
Professor Guo?
Okay, I think that's a fact that Bush administration moved from the strategic ambiguity to strategic clarity. And there are a couple of comments from his pressman and administration's talk, something like that. And just clearly indicated that U.S. only recognized the PRC as the sovereign government representing China. Whether or not the government said directly, the U.S. government said, well, Taiwan is part of China, that's probably not quoted directly from any statement, but my understanding is that if the PRC represents the whole China, therefore Taiwan is included. And so therefore that's the reason you switch recognition from Taiwan to mainland China. Otherwise you continue to maintain the ROC recognition.
Helen, do you want to speak to that point or just refer people to your book? Okay. While I'm thinking about it, for those of you who are standing in the back, we do have a few places up in the front if you'd like to sit down. Next question. Yes, in the back there. I guess that's Wayne Morrison.
Yeah, thank you. Considering the tightrope you have to walk on vis-a-vis China, I'm just curious about your impressions on U.S.-Taiwan economic relations, because it seems to me that those relations have not been so solid over the past few years. For example, we suspended the Trade and Investment Framework Agreement for over 5 years, and these issues regarding beef and pork, such as the ritopamine issue, it just seems surprising to me that this is something that continues to cause serious problems. You know, when Taiwan wants to get into the TPP, for example, you would think that there would be some more political support to deal with this issue so that Taiwan would be considered to be more ready to join the TPP. So I'm just wondering if some of the interest groups in Taiwan are so politically powerful, the ag issues, the beef, pork issue, is that such a serious problem domestically for Taiwan that it can't overcome to sort of improve its relationship with the United States?
Who would like to take on that question?
Maybe I can try.
Okay,
because
please.
The last part of my presentation, actually, I touch a little bit upon this particular issue. Actually, as I understand, when Tsai was in D.C. Some time ago, she was asked to say something about the liberalization of Taiwanese domestic politics, but she didn't say it enough on this particular ground. And what I'm trying to say at the last part of my presentation is exactly that without go further in terms of the liberalization of Taiwanese domestic politics, it is very difficult for Taiwan to join the TPP. And in that part, it will be interpreted as a distance from in terms of the relationship between Taiwan and the United States, and which is bad to Taiwan. So I think that's a very serious issue for whichever incoming Taiwanese leader to think about. Thank you.
Wayne, just a personal mischievous comment. One could ask the same question about interest groups in the United States and their influence over our economic policies and the way in which the U.S. Trade Representative's office sort of chooses to pursue the relationship. I think going back to the last question, Alan decided he had a comment.
Yeah, I don't want to get into a theological discussion of U.S. policy, but I guess I'd have to say I think U.S. policy is more nuanced than you suggest. That if you look at the documents, the U.S. has taken a position in which it doesn't challenge the assertion that there is one China, of which Taiwan and the mainland are both parts. But basically, it has said it leaves it up to the people on both sides of the strait to work that out. And so I don't think you would find support for the notion that, for example, at the United Nations, the U.S. accepts, or anywhere else, that the U.S. accepts that the government of the People's Republic of China speaks for Taiwan. It is absolutely true that the U.S. recognizes the government of the PRC as the sole legal government of China, but then it has this more nuanced expansion of that position.
Also, I'd say that if there was a shift from strategic ambiguity to strategic clarity, it applied to our willingness to come to Taiwan's defense in case of a crisis, and not to Taiwan's legal status and whether it belonged to China.
Yeah, but I would also say that I don't believe it has moved.
Yeah, I don't either.
Okay.
Yes, right here. Up this way. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm with the Law Center of Georgetown University. My question goes to Professor Huang. I recall that in your presentation you mentioned that you discouraged your students to do research on the trilateral research. And so I want you to shed more light on the reasons, and because you mentioned Taiwan is a democratic country, and so what are the reasons that you do research on this topic, but you don't like your students to take this research? And a workshop or a conference like today, is that likely to happen in Taiwan? Is that easy? Or actually it's also very sensitive? Thank you very much.
I think she's put you on the spot.
Well, you know, teaching jobs really does not give you a beautiful paycheck. But one good thing is that when you walk into a classroom, you are the commander-in-chief. And that's the beauty of teaching. You know, not every profession can enjoy that. Let me reiterate, you know, in my personal definition, if we want to have a trilateral relationship, then we must have three sets of bilateral relations, all workable or manageable. Or otherwise, we do not have a trilateral.
You know, so if you look at like this, this is U.S.-Taiwan, this is U.S.-China, and then you have cross-strait. So if you have a D-link, then all the diplomatic battleground will be in Washington, D.C., because we had experienced 10 years between 1998 and 2008 when cross-strait institutional dialogue and negotiations were suspended. So the problem is that how can one construct a trilateral when there is a D-link between, or there was no dialogue and negotiation through formal channels or authorized vehicles between Beijing and Taipei. That was my point. You know, I admit that I'm a dominating professor. I do not negotiate with my students, and that's my style. Thank you.
Next question. I'll ask a question. I guess this probably goes to Professor Wu. It's my impression that from 2000 to 2008, the activity of Taiwan companies in the mainland actually increased a great deal, yes. That they went around the Taiwan government in spite of the fact that institutional and political relations were pretty bad. Do you expect the same thing to happen if Tsai Ing-wen should become president?
Oh, you mean increase?
Yes.
No, I think actually we don't have to wait until the next administration. Actually, the trend is already clear recently. We have witnessed a whole bunch of Taiwanese companies try to pull out from China and to some other places, just like what I think the Mr. Shah had already mentioned about that. But there is another serious problem, actually. There were several very famous companies and enterprises cases which have already existed in the Chinese market for the last 20 years or something, legally, but recently under great pressures to close their operations. And I think that will send a very negative signals to all of the people in Taiwan that you cannot trust mainland China, especially in terms of your property rights. And I think that's a very big mistake that the Chinese government or is doing, no matter it's because of the local government or it's because of the central government. When you deprive people's property, especially without any clear patterns, then you create tremendous uncertainty, and people are afraid of that, and distrust mounting among many Chinese businessmen, and I think that's extremely detrimental to the cross-strait relations.
Jay Taylor. Hello? Is this on? Jay Taylor, independent writer. Alan Rumberg, please. Alan, your analysis suggests that the events of the past 8 years, can you hear me? Your analysis suggests that the events of the past 8 years under Ma Ying-jeou have made it virtually impossible for the DPP to divert in any significant way from President Ma's policies. At the same time, wouldn't you agree that these same developments have made it very difficult, but hardly impossible, but very difficult for the PRC to depart from its support for the status quo policies and instead to seek some new departure, such as timetable. In other words, the prospects for a really long indefinite prolongation of the status quo has been markedly improved.
Thank you, Jay, because I had some other comments I wanted to make, and you opened the door to my making them. I'm not sure it's only sort of policies. It's the development of, well, it's the policies that have led to developments, which I think have solidified a lot of these, or consolidated a lot of these relationships in the interest of both sides of the strait. I mean, one thing I was going to say is that the Chen Shui-bian era created a lot of angst in the mainland, and as people have pointed out, in the United States. And some of that hangs over now, because when you listen to PRC people talk about this election, officials and scholars who are closely connected to officials, it's always sort of, well, Tsai Ing-wen was responsible for this or that or the other thing under the Chen Shui-bian administration, and they don't trust her. And I think that's something people need to take into account. But I would also say that the Chen Shui-bian period made Beijing face up to what really mattered. And so they came up with what somebody's referred to as the anti-secession law. So as opposed to a previous period in which all sorts of things would possibly lead to use of force or threat to use force, including the passage of a certain amount of time without a negotiated unification agreement, that's not where they are today. In law, it now only talks about three conditions, basically that come down to either moving toward independence or setting the ball rolling toward independence in some irreversible fashion or absolutely blocking reunification. Otherwise, I think that the scenario you sort of identify is basically right. I think the problem that a number of people see today, particularly in the mainland, is concern that, in fact, the DPP, whatever Tsai or others in the DPP may say now during the election, once they're in office, if they get to office, may pursue policies that, in fact, are more independence-oriented. And if I would, I don't happen to think that's likely, because I don't think people in Taiwan are going to tolerate dangerous policies. I didn't think they would do it under Chen Shui-bian. I don't think they'll do it under anybody. But if that were to happen, my judgment is that no matter what the relationship with the United States is, that the leadership in Beijing would have no choice but to act in some fashion to reverse that if other factors didn't lead to a reversal of that. I think, you know, when they talk about core interests, I think that we need, in this particular sense, to take that very seriously. So I agree with you. I think that basically the setup is that there will be an extended period as the two sides relate to one another, not necessarily smoothly always, and maybe we're heading to a period where it won't be so smooth, I don't know. And I don't rule out that at the end of the day, they can come to terms which would be satisfactory on both sides, not through their current ways of thinking, but there are ways of getting, I think, to that position. But I don't think that anybody is looking for a fight. I don't see how you would come to the conclusion in Beijing that if you weren't forced into that position, it would be in your interest to do that. And I certainly don't see why anybody in Taiwan would think it would be in their interest given the likely consequences of any move in that direction.
Could I push you on that a little bit? I think you suggested that there were things that Beijing might do just to indicate that things had changed. And international space is the area where this seems to be most obvious. I guess my fear is that while Beijing may feel that these are limited steps, they would have a psychological impact within Taiwan, among the public, among the political class, that would create pressures on a President Tsai to respond in some way. So you have a negative spiral developing.
I think that's right, and I think that the PRC needs to think hard about what steps they might take, lest they indeed do set off such a cycle. I still would argue that both sides have a fundamental interest, if not forced into a really harsh security-related kind of confrontation in limiting that. For example, if Beijing were to say to a number of Taiwan's current diplomatic partners who've indicated they really would kind of like to switch, that, well, we've held you off, but, you know, it's okay. You want to come along, we'll open the door. They might do that. Who would get the blame for that? I don't think the DPP would likely get the blame for that. I think that the PRC would get the blame for that. So, you know, would that lead to a really huge kind of crisis? Not if the leadership in Taiwan is handling this in a sensible way. And I think people in Taiwan need to be ready for some negative consequences. And I think probably they are. I think some of the talk about how, well, we can get around some of the PRC's restrictions, for example, on economic agreements, is a little bit of wishful thinking, in the sense that, as Minister Xia indicated, the PRC is already blocking agreements. I don't see how, frankly, Taiwan joins the TPP if Beijing opposes it. That is, it isn't just a matter of the United States, which I think would and should favor Taiwan's participation if it is economically merited. I don't think it is yet in that position, and it would be very difficult to get there. But if it is, my view is that the USG shouldn't oppose that. But there are 11 other countries at this point. And so I think that Taiwan's application is quite vulnerable in that sense if Beijing wants to object. Yeah, there could be a negative spiral, and I would hope that people in Beijing would think hard about what they want to do that makes their point, and what actually could really harm things in a fundamental way over the long run. As I say, I think that even the people who say, let's not punish Taiwan, yes, and slow down, this and that, so on, but they're prepared for a cooling of relations for some time.
Maybe just a few words. I think one of the things that they might do is to cut the allowed visitor to Taiwan in half, for example, or even altogether. And in that way, actually, I think a lot of Taiwanese business may have to, actually that's what I did. Actually, some time ago, I suggest to some of my friends in the business world to conduct a pressure test on their financial and cash flow. What if, you know, suddenly the incoming visitors cut into half or even altogether, and is that going to cause financial pressures or cash flow pressures on your business? If that's the case, you'd better prepare for that, because I think that's quite likely to happen at the second part of the 2016 or the first part of the 2017. So I think that's another possibility.
Well, there are different scenarios. We can add it up on our list. From the suffering of our diplomatic relationship to the cut down of the tourists from China. I have been working with some of the friends, including partly with the government agencies, to run scenarios. Mm-hmm. I think the more we get into it, I run three already. The most difficult thing is still international participation part. Mm-hmm. Suffering of, cut down of their diplomatic allies, the impact was smaller, mm-hmm. compares to a bigger impact through my own game, is that next spring that Taiwan does not receive the invitation to the World Health Assembly. And people react relatively strongly compared to
that another diplomatic ally been lost. So I think we still have time that we need to go through different layers of possible scenarios. Beijing also needs to understand that if they tightened their, you know, policy statement and does not allow a flexibility of interpretation. And for instance, the 1992 consensus is the anchor of cross-strait relations. You know, if you do not allow some kind of flexibility, irreversibly will tighten your own hands as well. So I think both sides needs to understand that it is not in anybody's interest to have a spiral that negative enough to ignite military conflict. Of course, there are other scenarios that could involve in the armed forces on both sides, for instance, in East China Sea or South China Sea. But that's something that we all need to study carefully. We still have time.
Okay, thanks, Professor Guo.
Yeah, I don't think the mainland will take an all-or-nothing approach. They probably will still separate the people to people, economy to economy, party to party, government to government. So if Tsai Ing-wen win and take some proactive policy, Taiwan, most probably just stop all the official exchanges. But you will see the economic activity continue to go on, and people to people probably will continue to go on.
Please.
First of all, on the tourism issue, I agree, they could do that. I think it may be a mistake for the reasons that you're citing. And as I said to a group here not so long ago in commenting on Tom Christensen's book, the view that you get from officials in the PRC is, well, of course we wouldn't stop it. But people just wouldn't want to go to Taiwan in that circumstance. I mean, you know, there's a risk. That they will alienate a lot of people by hurting a lot of businesses doing that. I agree that they will try and separate things the way you just described. One of the issues there, though, is are these buying missions all, are they official? When they're led by a provincial party leader, is that a party activity? Is it private? I think it's going to be hard for them to figure out how they want to slice that. But I agree with you. They will try to do that. Two other points. I think that on the 92 consensus, you know, they've made clear for quite some time, the point is, even though the 92 consensus is how it's expressed, when you read into their statements, what they're really saying is the essence is one China, of which Taiwan and the mainland are both a part. So I don't think that the words 92 consensus are really very important if you get the essence. But I think that if anybody challenges the essence, that's where things will get very difficult for Beijing to ignore it. If, as I said before, they simply don't endorse that position, then it raises a question in my mind about how far Beijing really would want to go. One other word. Minister Xia mentioned a word that I have used many times and others in this room have used many times in dealing with our PRC friends, which is dignity. Beijing likes to talk about fair and reasonable arrangements with dialogue and so on and so forth. And to a certain extent, you can see how that is sort of happening, but maybe not in everybody's view. But I think that they have paid grossly insufficient attention to the question of the feeling of dignity. And I think that, Alexander, what people are reacting to when you raise this question about the World Health Assembly. Yes, there are some substantive things that go on there, but it really is sort of dignity. And I'm sure there are people in the PRC system who understand this, but I don't get a sense that so far it has informed their approach in a sufficient way to help them win hearts and minds as they would really like to.
Thank you. I have a question back here, and then we'll come over here. Right there. You have a mic.
Norman Fu. I'm with the China Times. I have a two-part question for Mr. Romberg. Other than what Tsai Ing-wen said in public during her visit here, are you aware of any private and more reassuring assurances that she may have given to U.S. officials in her meetings with them. This is the first part. The second part, Xi Jinping is coming in September for a visit. Obviously, the possibility of Tsai Ing-wen becoming the next president in Taiwan is a matter of a serious concern. When he meets with President Obama, do you care to speculate as to how President Obama will address his concerns about Tsai Ing-wen or the DPP becoming the party in power in 2016? Thank you.
Alan?
Thanks, Norman. First of all, on the question of what Tsai may have said in public to U.S. government officials, in private to U.S. government officials, since we have Ray Burkhardt speaking later, I'll pass the ball. But I guess my position is essentially what you see is what you get. She's trying to try, in my view, as I said in my remarks, convey the view, the impression, and convince people that what she is saying is not going to upset the apple cart. She's not going to endorse one China. She's not going to forswear the notion of ultimate Taiwan independence. That she's just not going to address those things, I think. But she's, if you look at what she said, including at the CSIS speech, she's trying to make it clear that she's going to support, as she puts it, the status quo of peace and stability. I'm not going to go beyond that on that. Xi Jinping and Barack Obama, I would see no reason to assume that the president, the U.S. president, will say anything different from what U.S. presidents have said for a long time about our policy. I think it's a pretty consistent position. We don't support Taiwan independence. We don't support any outcome. We don't support unification either, frankly. What we support is a peaceful, non-coerced, mutually willing process to resolve issues between Taiwan and the mainland. And we've used a lot of our energy to try to do that over a very long period of time.
Norman, I also think that Susan Thornton's talk here at Brookings on May 21st provides some guidance about what President Obama might say in the sort of circumstance we will be in come September. And this will be the last question.
Oh, Steve Winters, independent researcher. It's getting back to the comment about the mainland attempting to win hearts and minds. I haven't heard any references here to this whole thing about Silk Roads, a maritime Silk Road right through the middle of Eurasia to who knows where, Rotterdam. How is this resonating with the people in Taiwan, if at all, and particularly with the youth? Because, of course, this to some people seems, in Asia, seems like the future, and who wants to be cut out of the future?
Who would like to speak to this? Professor Guo.
Yeah, my paper touched upon a little bit, but I didn't have time to talk about it. I think that's part of the Taiwan's marginalization. So far, they have shown no interest in the One Belt, One Road project. And probably Taiwan are not in that position to contribute significantly in any monetary term either. You know, they want to join the AIIB, but you know, China has not agreed to that yet. I don't know, it's something waiting to be seen, what role Taiwan can play in China's strategic move to build this close relationship with Central and Europe through the landmass.
But there are, to my knowledge, there are more than a dozen joint research projects that Taiwan universities and research centers that are working with their mainland China counterparts on the One Belt, One Road strategy. If we are talking about industries or business, not yet. but how, you know, China would shape this One Belt, One Road. Taiwan has participated a lot on those. Thank you.
Richard, just one final, to go back to Norman's question and to supplement what both you and I said. The U.S., as I said, doesn't support any particular outcome, but what it has said is that it opposes unilateral efforts by either side to change the status quo, and I think there was a lot in Susan Thornton's remarks that addressed that. So I agree with Richard on that, but I think that's been an explicit position of the USG for some time.
On your question, the initiative, the PRC initiative that Taiwan has responded to is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and Taiwan would said very quickly that it wanted to be a part of that. Beijing deflected them in moving towards the inaugural meeting. The issue is now hung up over what Taiwan will be called and under what political status it would participate. And so, as in all things, it comes back to politics. With that, we bring this session to a close. Thanks to the panelists for their presentations and their responses to questions. Thank you for your questions. We now move to lunch, and lunch will be through the double doors along the side here. And if it's laid out the way we usually do it, it's a buffet lunch, you can get the same food from either side of the table. So you don't have to go on just one side. I hope that you can sort of move through the line and come back to your seat as quickly as possible, because we're having Ray Burghardt speak at 12:30. And maybe Ray should go first so he can get some food. So thank you again.